It happens again in a school, this time in Texas. Make no mistake, this is a uniquely American problem.
In terms of all the developed countries, we have by far the most guns, and we have the weakest gun laws.
But some countries offer a roadmap to a safer future. Also today, Shanghai's COVID lockdown continues to drag on. Many longtime residents are fed up and heading for the exits.
I just decided that I'm done.
But getting out of Shanghai right now is easier said than done. I'm Marco Werman, and migrants fleeing to the U.S., crossing the Rio Grande, can be deadly. Now some prepare in advance for the swift current. A professional in Nicaragua is giving free swim lessons. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Another deadly shooting in the United States, an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. Again, outrage and raw emotions and questions about how to stop this from happening. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, site of the tragic Sandy Hook school shooting, spoke about this latest tragedy.
These kids weren't unlucky. This only happens in this country and nowhere else.
By the numbers, Murphy is right. Gun deaths in the U.S. are off the charts compared with other rich nations. David Hemingway knows all about this. He's the director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center, which collects and analyzes gun violence data. David, Senator Chris Murphy highlighted the U.S. as exceptional when it comes to gun violence. What does the data say?
Well, what the data indicate is that when you compare the United States to the other high-income countries, we are an average country in terms of most crime and most violence, in terms of assaults, in terms of sexual assaults, in terms of robbery and so forth. If you look at our high school students, they don't seem very different than other high school students in all sorts of measures in terms of violence. But where we are so different is in terms of guns. We have by far the most guns. We have particularly by far the most handguns and by far the most military weapons, which are in civilian use. And we have the weakest gun laws. The United States, a child, for example, in the United States, we're looking at the 5 to 14-year-olds, which is K through 8, elementary school, middle school. And you pick those because it's so hard to blame the victim, and there's so much victim blaming in the United States. A child in the United States is more likely to be murdered with a gun than children in Japan or England or France or Norway or Australia. And it's not like 50% higher or twice as high or three times as high. It's 20 times higher. And the same way, if you look at suicide, firearm suicide deaths, child in the United States is like 10 times more likely to commit suicide with a firearm. These are 5 to 14-year-olds. And of course, maybe 20 times more likely to have an unintentional firearm death.
So in your research, is it as simple as more guns equals more gun violence?
That seems to be the variable that is the most, that changes the most across countries. It's not like some countries have horrible, rich countries have a lot of people who are try to be mass murderers. People, as I mentioned, have similar rates of general violence. Guns make violence lethal. They make it so easy to kill. So, for example, in the United States, if you compare our police to, say, German police, a police officer in the United States is 30 times more likely to be killed on the job as a police officer in Germany. And why is that? Because how do you kill police? The only way you kill them, basically, is with guns. And we have lots of guns. And not surprisingly, citizens in the United States are about 30 times more likely than citizens in Germany per capita to be killed by police. Why? Because police are afraid for good reason, because they could get killed in an instant. If you look within states in the United States which have fewer guns and stronger laws, do much better than the states which have lots of guns and weaker laws. You can see this in terms of the school shootings and the mass shootings, but you can also see it like in terms of police. Where are police likely to get killed in the United States? And the answer is, in the states where there's lots of guns. Where are citizens likely to get killed by police? In the states where there's lots of guns.
Can a nation have guns and fewer gun homicides? I mean, do you see a country that has both?
The answer is, it seems to be yes. Countries which have a fair number of guns, tend to do a little worse than countries with almost no guns. But it's the differences across, like a lot of European countries, it's not that huge differences, except maybe for England, about how many guns there are. And so where you can see, it's easy to see differences is when the number of guns is so differently great, and also the gun laws are so different. And that's, the United States is sort of by itself. In the United States, it's harder when there are more guns. But, you know, one of the things that we study is how you can have, how we could live with guns. Since we're going to have lots of guns, how can we live with guns? Right now, we're dying with guns. And there's lots of reasonable policies that could make it so that we have lots of guns and still don't kill ourselves so often.
The U.S. is off the charts with gun ownership. Australia often comes up as a model for how to change. We need to go back to 1996 and the mass shooting in Tasmania. Help us understand how Australia managed to change the path they were on.
And the key thing, I believe, in Australia after the Tasmania, after the Port Arthur shootings, was that you had a conservative prime minister.
John Howard.
Not some sort of liberal lefty prime minister, but a conservative prime minister who basically said, enough is enough. And they said, the first thing we're going to do is try to stop these mass shootings by buying back mandatorily these weapons, which can kill lots of people quickly. And they did that, and basically mass shootings, there weren't any mass shootings for about the next 25 years. It's incredible. But then they did something else much more important, I think, in the long run, which is they said, we're going to strengthen our gun laws, but we're going to harmonize our gun laws, is what they said. It's going to have similar strong gun laws across all the states.
Did Australia at the time have to battle a powerful gun lobby? And if so, what was that like?
They had a minor gun lobby, not nearly as strong as the U.S. gun lobby. Indeed, the U.S. gun lobby went to Australia and tried to increase its power. The one good thing we do is I think they, when you're talking about the gun lobby in Australia, is that we make it so that the winning argument in virtually any country when you're thinking about gun issues and gun policies is, do you want to end up like the United States? And I would think no rich country wants to end up like the United States in terms of our gun issues.
I mean, the very basic question is, what can be done to end the cycle, which we hear over and over again? Is there a single policy the U.S. could duplicate from Australia that would make a significant difference in gun violence?
Sort of. Well, no. If we're going to have lots of guns, we have to have lots of reasonable policies that help reduce the problem. If we had no guns, you wouldn't need any other policies. But we have lots of guns, and so it's not like a single panacea. We talk in injury prevention about the motor vehicle success story. And motor vehicles are so much safer than they were when I was growing up. And it wasn't one thing. It wasn't like, oh, we have airbags now, everything's safer. No, airbags help, but, and seatbelts help, and side impact performance standards help, and rollover standards help, and better roads help, and collapsible steering columns help, and on and on and on and on. You get so many different changes. And that's what you need if you want to have a lot of something which is, by its nature, fairly dangerous, like guns are. I teach in public health, and we have so many international students, and they just cannot understand the United States. Like, how can this happen? How can you not do anything?
David Hemenway is a professor of public health policy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. Sorry to be speaking with you about this again, David, but thank you very much for your thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
For migrants trying to enter the United States at the southern border, they face many dangers along the way. They can be robbed, kidnapped, extorted. When they finally reach the U.S.-Mexico border, some face one other danger, getting across the Rio Grande. Some migrants, though, arrive prepared for that. The world's TBC Isaiah reports.
In Spanish, they call it Rio Bravo, which means fierce river. And there is a good reason for that, says José Loya, who recently made the crossing. The current doesn't take you to where you want to go, he says. You have to be able to control your nerves. Loya is an undocumented immigrant from Venezuela. The river is about 1,900 miles long, forming the international border between Texas and Mexico. The water is shallow in some places, but those areas are controlled by smugglers, Loya tells me, and they demand money to be able to cross.
Hay sitios que se pasan bajitos, pero esos son los que uno paga.
Loya says that's why he chose a more risky spot, where the water is deeper. He made it across safely, but others don't. A journalist named Calixto Rojas fled from Nicaragua. The reason, he wrote in a letter, was political repression. About a month ago, Rojas tried to swim across the river. In this video, recorded by a Fox News reporter, you can see Rojas struggling to tread water. His friend is nearby, holding onto a cement pillar, screaming for help. Eventually, Rojas goes under and does not come back up. He drowned. This was witnessed by dozens of people, including Mexican and U.S. border officials who were on the scene, but they had been told not to attempt any rescues. That's after a member of the National Guard lost his life trying to save a woman from the river just weeks before. The recent news of people drowning in the Rio Grande encouraged a professional swimmer in Nicaragua to offer a public service.
Eso.
Mario Orozco owns a swimming school in the city of Estelí. He's teaching free lessons for Nicaraguans planning to cross the Rio Grande. And he sent me this video.
Esta iniciativa la tomamos cuando nos dimos cuenta que murieron varias amistades de nosotros.
We took the initiative after several of my friends died while trying to cross the river, he says.
Y fue muy conmovedor de que si yo sabía las técnicas en aguas abiertas.
This was a tragedy, he says, so I decided to teach people how to swim in open waters. Orozco has said that he doesn't encourage people to attempt to cross into the U.S., but he wants to help them survive if they decide to try. Another person helping migrants is Valeria Wheeler. She runs a shelter called Mission Border Hope in Eagle Pass, Texas, right across the river. Her shelter welcomes 500 people a day. And Wheeler says she's seen three families so far this year who've lost a loved one to drowning.
They don't even have the time to grieve because they have to go and recognize the body of their family member, go to the funeral home to make the arrangements so they can take their family member with them.
This can be expensive, she says, and traumatic. But these stories are not deterring people from coming to the U.S. In April of this year, more than 230,000 people tried to cross the border, according to Customs and Border Patrol. That's more than double the number from the same month in 2019, before the pandemic. Valeria Wheeler says as long as the legal path for crossing the border remains closed, more migrants will keep trying to make it across the Rio Grande. For the world, I am Divisay Sea.
Shanghai is inching closer to the end of lockdown after weeks of strict COVID measures, but getting out of Shanghai, not so easy. Our story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Nearly 2 months of strict lockdown in Shanghai, and people there are beyond exhausted. Many just want to leave. But as The World's Rebecca Cantha reports from Shanghai, easier said than done.
These days, the hot topic in Shanghai is getting out of here. Last week, videos began circulating of long lines of people at the train station waiting to leave. Many of them were migrant workers who'd been out of a job for months. One video that went viral featured interviews with people who had walked or ridden their bikes to the station with luggage in tow. This man says, "I'm just leaving my bike behind." Other people, those with money or an education, are making plans to leave China altogether. Shanghai is considered the most advanced city in the country. The fact that the lockdown has gone so poorly was a wake-up call.
A lot of people thought Shanghai would be an exception, and Shanghai could control things pretty well.
Mimi Zhang went to college in the U.S. and then worked in Silicon Valley. She returned to China 2 years ago, splitting her time between Shanghai and her parents' home in a nearby province. Even though she escaped Shanghai's lockdown, she's ready to make a life elsewhere.
How could people imagine in the 21st century in China, there's no war and I am starving? That is a very horrible thing, and that deepens people's fear about staying here.
Zhang says she will go abroad again to get her master's degree and hopefully gain U.S. citizenship. But the clock is ticking. China has stopped issuing new passports, and it's discouraging international travel except for emergencies. Hamilton Lee is an immigration lawyer in Shanghai. He says he's been getting a lot of calls. Lee says many of his clients are thinking about where they can move. Canada and Singapore are popular options. Shanghai's foreign population is clearing out, too. KF is a South American woman who asked to only use her initials for privacy. She has been locked inside her high-rise apartment with her 8-year-old son for nearly 3 months. The experience has taken its toll.
I had no plans to leave. No plans to leave China. But after this, my son developed depression and eating disorder.
She has lived in Shanghai for 16 years, and it won't be easy to pick up and go. But the zero COVID policy is driving her away. She will make preparations to leave as soon as this lockdown is lifted.
Because they're not going to change the policy, and I can't risk to have it again. So I just decided that I'm done.
Chat groups have sprung up across Shanghai to help people who want to get out. Crystal Sirocco is from the Bahamas, but she grew up in Shanghai and calls it home. She has no plans to leave, but she's helping others. She says the logistics of getting out during lockdown are tricky.
So there's just a lot of confusion as to what is actually needed to leave.
Sirocco has been giving advice on how to find a driver when taxis and subways aren't running, where to get a bilingual COVID test to get into the airport, and the biggest one, how to persuade your housing compound to let you out. Sometimes it requires a letter from the government.
And then you have some compounds who just said, no, we don't care who calls us, you're not leaving.
This has been a huge problem for people who went ahead and booked flights out of Shanghai. Some were allowed to leave their compounds, but only if they promised not to return. Unlucky travelers whose flights were canceled wound up marooned at the airport. Other people with flights out have been bringing food to share with the stranded passengers. One man was stuck at Pudong International Airport for 5 weeks. He declined an interview for this story, saying that he's writing a screenplay about his experience. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Turkey's foreign minister did something unexpected today. He visited Israel. It is the first time a senior Turkish official has visited Israel in 15 years. The two countries don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, but that might be starting to change. With us to talk about this is İlhan Tanir. He's an independent Turkish journalist and analyst and joins us from his base in Washington. 15 years is a long time in diplomacy, İlhan. How big a deal is this visit? Are you prepared to call it Turkish-Israeli rapprochement?
I believe so, yes. This is definitely one of the biggest turn of events in the last decade or so. As we have been following these two countries and relations going up and down. So after all those ups and downs, and now we are seeing a Turkish foreign minister in Israel and giving these very upbeat remarks and hopeful messages for the future, I think we can say that this is a fully rapprochement between the countries.
So let's talk about what this visit from Turkish Foreign Minister Cavusoglu to Israel actually means. How did it come about?
Turkey began making some U-turns with its relations, whether it was with UAE, which was another, with the Saudi Arabia, with the Israel. Turkey was basically trying to reach out these regional powers, mend the ties once again, as there was Trump was going out of the office and President Biden was coming in the office. It appears that they thought it is time to get along as the United States is withdrawing from the region.
So what do you think Turkey gets out of this new relationship with Israel?
Turkey has been isolated for several years, and its economy is doing... It doesn't have any reserves right now. It is minus $70 billion. Turkey's inflation is out of control. So basically, it appears that Turkish leadership thought that, including Israel, it needs to get along, it needs to do better with its trade. And also next year, there will be an election. It will be a huge implications. And Mr. Erdogan needs to rapidly repair whatever he can do to repair the economy.
And what about Israel? How do they benefit from a friendly relationship with Turkey?
Israel always wanted to get along with Turkey. Turkey was the first country to recognize Israeli state in, I believe, 1948. And one of the very few Muslim-majority countries also having full diplomatic relations with Israel. But definitely there are many incentives, including energy, trade, tourism, and many more.
Today, during his visit, Foreign Minister Cavusoglu visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Israel knew about that visit, but what do you think the message is that Cavusoglu was sending by going there?
I believe Foreign Minister himself stated that the Turkish relations with Palestine is going to be separate from Turkish relations with Israel. He also added that actually warm relations with Israel will help Palestinian cause.
How do you think Israel will react to those comments?
For now, we don't see much reaction. But for the last several months, Ankara has been quiet, very careful not to hurt relations with Israel. And I believe Israel understands this. And I believe Turkish relations with Palestine is not an issue for Israel as long as Turkey keeps it diplomatically and, you know, not going over the line.
İlhan Tanir is an independent Turkish journalist and analyst based in Washington. Thank you very much for your thoughts and your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. American multinationals have long profited from oil in Iraq. Now, increasingly, China is getting in on the action there. Plus, we take you to the extreme sport of highlining, tightrope walking, and some pretty risky places.
Yo creo que ahí uno se siente vivo cuando está tan cerca de la muerte.
This highliner says being so close to peril makes you feel alive. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We've all heard about long COVID when symptoms, including heart problems and trouble breathing, just continue to linger. More than a third of people may experience at least one symptom of long COVID a month after being infected. That's according to a new study from the CDC. There are few treatments available, but in the UK, an unusual partnership between a group of medical specialists and artists is tackling one of long COVID's most debilitating symptoms. The World's Alana Gordon reports.
So we're breathing in together through noses.
On a Zoom, Abigail Kelly leads a group of 15 people across England through breathing exercises. She lifts her hands up when breathing in, and on the exhale,
we're all going to push our hands forward.
In another exercise, she has everyone imagine they're casting spells and making the sound go with it.
And again.
And then conjuring up a magical donut.
I want you to just smell that glorious magical donut.
Smiles spread across the screen. Participants in this breathing course have been referred by clinicians because they have long COVID. 39-year-old Maria Schiffner got COVID in early 2020, but symptoms continued.
God, it took me months to be able to even go for a walk with my dog again and just do little things. Like, I couldn't even walk up the stairs without standing there, like, catching my breath going, what on earth is just up with me?
I carried a lot of shame around for a long time.
58-year-old Brent Hinks has also been living with post-COVID symptoms for more than 2 years. He says he sometimes gets this sensation, like he's in a tunnel that's collapsing on his chest.
But what would happen is I would wake up in the middle of the night and just gasp, absolutely gasping. It's terrifying. And you think, I can't breathe. I'm going to die. I don't know what to do.
Instructors like Abigail Kelly are trying to help, but they're not respiratory therapists. at least not the traditional ones. Helly is a professional singer and instructor with one of Britain's main opera companies, the English National Opera.
I am totally obsessed with my breathing.
And obsessed with trying to find total relaxation with her breath. Otherwise,
I might try and attempt to sing a ridiculously high note. And immediately what will happen is that my brain will start going, you can't do that, that's too high, what are you trying to do, don't do that. And then what that will have is a knock-on effect to my breathing. My breathing will go into that tight, high place where I then don't have any access to the lower part of my happy, normal breathing mechanism.
Helly says she's learned to get out of the way of her breath. In the summer and fall of 2020, after the performance stage went dark and it was clear that long COVID was a thing, the opera company connected with respiratory therapists at Imperial College Healthcare in London to try and help. Together, doctors and singers developed this 6-week course aimed at helping people with breathlessness, that uncomfortable feeling of not being able to breathe enough. For patients with long COVID, breathlessness can have physical causes, from changes to their hearts, lungs, and muscles. And when it goes wrong, it can be hard to get that breath back to normal.
So as we become anxious about being breathless, and as we change the way in which we breathe in a less efficient way, that actually creates a bit more of a vicious cycle in which people can become more breathless.
Dr. Keir Phillips at Imperial College London is a researcher with this opera project. He says the idea is that for certain long COVID patients, an opera program might help break some of that downward spiral.
Rather than trying to strengthen muscles and do exercise training type approaches, what you're doing there is you're actually just changing the pattern in which people breathe or the muscles which are being used. And also, to some extent, the emotional response to the stimuli of breathing as well.
Now, a course led by opera singers wouldn't be complete without some singing, but it's low-key singing. Lullabies, meant to soothe and relax the mind, too. Brent Hinks.
And the other lovely thing is they always did simple lullabies because when you have this thing, you can't remember anything. So that you need something you can repeat.
He says it felt good, but something else felt good.
And it felt like being part of a community for the first time because you are very isolated. You're at home all the time.
This month, the program's creators published results from a formal trial of the program. They found that it didn't have a major impact on people's physical health, but there was a notable improvement in people's quality of life and mental health, and sessions gave patients helpful ways to deal with their breathlessness. Hannah Davis, co-founder of a patient-led research initiative on long COVID, is glad this therapy might be helpful to some patients. But she says what's needed most is more research into all the underlying physical causes of long COVID symptoms and what to do about it.
You know, I would definitely like to see us move into more substantial clinical trials on medications that may be able to help more substantially, for sure.
More than 1,000 people across Britain have now taken part in the program. It's being replicated in Wales. Organizers say there's interest from more than 24 countries. For Brent Hinks, who took the course a few months ago, he doesn't think his long COVID is going away. Neither is the breathlessness. But it's different now.
I still get it. It hasn't gone. I've gone out for long walks, and I shouldn't have done that, really. In the middle of the woods, when my chest is really bad, and it just, you can just stop. And think. I think, right, now what do they tell me? And I'll do put my hands behind my head or do something. And I breathe and I think, do you know what? I'm not going to die. I'll be fine.
He says he's learning to deal with it. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
As the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to overturn Roe v. Wade, we at The World have been reporting on how other countries handle abortion. In the United Kingdom, abortion has been legal since 1967, but not in Northern Ireland. The procedure was decriminalized there just 3 years ago, but as Andrew Connolly reports from Belfast, access to abortion remains far from straightforward.
For a long time, anyone in Northern Ireland needing an abortion for any reason had two choices: break the law or leave the country.
For decades and longer, women in Northern Ireland were forced to travel in
nearly all circumstances if they needed abortion health care or they were forced to seek abortion by backstreet means.
Naomi Connor is with the campaign group Alliance for Choice. We meet at a restaurant in downtown Belfast. Historically, this is the most socially conservative part of the UK. Abortion has been the third rail of Northern Irish politics, and even now, it's a painful legacy for many.
But I think the biggest thing was that women had to do it in secrecy, with a deep, deep, pervasive sense of stigma, worry and shame if anyone found out.
Being forced to travel to England, where abortion was legal, was the reality for many, including Connor herself.
I travelled for an abortion 8 years ago. It probably cost them in around £1,000 to £1,100 because you had to fund the procedure then, the flights. That was okay because I had a credit card, but I was thinking about the women and the pregnant people who didn't.
Northern Ireland's power-sharing government was set up after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. Major parties have frequently let disagreements lead to government shutdowns. It was during one such shutdown in 2019 that an amendment to decriminalise abortion here was passed by Parliament in London. But 3 years later, abortion is still difficult to access. Fiona Bloomer is a specialist on abortion policy at Ulster University. She says underfunding puts a strain on medical professionals.
Those, for instance, the abortion providers are doing this on top of their additional duties and they don't have the full resources that they need. We're essentially having a service that's been operated on the basis of their goodwill.
This means that the full range of abortion services required by British law is patchy at best and in some areas non-existent here. Bloomer says Conservative politicians here are putting people at risk, particularly during the pandemic.
Many abortion services switched to being online provision of services, but our Minister for Health in Northern Ireland refused to allow that to happen. And as a result, at the height of the pandemic, women and pregnant people who needed early medical abortion still had to travel to an abortion clinic to access that.
After the new policy went into effect, the number of abortions performed in Northern Ireland went up. Anti-abortion campaigners like Bernadette Smith were dismayed.
We were outraged at what actually happened. Our government was undermined. The people were undermined.
Smith is the founder of an advocacy group called Precious Life. Its office is adorned with motivational quotes and rubber models of wombs. Smith has been campaigning against abortion for 3 decades.
Well, abortion isn't healthcare, so there was no need for abortion to be implemented here by our existing government. I would say we still maintain that pro-life culture, unlike the United Kingdom, where women can have 3, 4, 5 abortions. It becomes part of the culture because it's legal.
Smith tells me she's not backing down, especially now that the US Supreme Court looks set to make a major reversal on abortion. And she hopes to see the younger generation in Northern Ireland take up the cause. But Mick Fealty, editor of the influential political news website Slugger O'Toole, says that's not the way things are going.
Social conservatism in Northern Ireland is not on the march. It's actually on the retreat.
Historically, this region is divided between Catholics and Protestants. Religious leaders from both traditions tend to be anti-abortion, but a major survey on social attitudes in Northern Ireland recently revealed that a third of the population says they don't belong to either religion.
And I think that group is going to increasingly have a disproportionate influence, I think, on future direction in Northern Ireland.
Naomi Connor, the abortion rights activist, says developments in the US are only adding to the sense of urgency.
We're always going to have to be vigilant. Always, because we never take the justice, the rights, the access for granted. The moment you start taking it for granted is when it can sort of slip away.
Abortion used to be a criminal offence here, but those days are gone, and now Sinn Féin is the majority party, once staunchly against abortion rights, now in favour. Just another sign of rapidly changing times for Northern Ireland. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly, Belfast.
Iraq has the fifth largest oil reserves in the world. Western companies such as ExxonMobil work with Baghdad to get Iraqi oil to market. But in recent years, China has emerged as one of the biggest players in Iraqi oil, and that is raising questions. Ben Van Heuvelen is editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report, which draws on a network of journalists across Iraq. Ben joins us from New York City. Ben, first of all, help us understand the role that oil plays in Iraq's economy.
Well, oil is Iraq's economy. It accounts for about 90% of the government's revenue. It's by far the largest source of GDP and is indirectly the largest source of employment because the Iraqi government is the largest employer in the country and depends on oil to pay public sector salaries.
And who actually owns Iraq's oil fields?
According to the Iraqi constitution, the Iraqi people own Iraq's oil fields. The oil companies take a relatively small fee for helping to produce the oil. And this is actually a point of contention between the companies and the government, because compared to projects in all of the other parts of the world, Iraq actually keeps a very high percentage of its oil revenue, which means that on the other side of it, oil companies have relatively low incentive to go to Iraq and invest there.
So we've been following the news about the U.S. oil giant ExxonMobil and the Russian oil company Lukoil. Both have been trying to sell some of their oil fields in Iraq, or at least their stake in it. What do the U.S. and Russia want out of Iraq?
I think that the U.S. government and the Russian government would love for their companies to stay in Iraq. Generally, when oil companies are in a country, your level of influence goes up. And in general, also, governments want to promote the commercial interests of companies from their respective countries. The reason that the companies want to leave, however, is that the contracts don't offer very attractive returns.
So the government in Washington would like ExxonMobil to stay. But if ExxonMobil and Russia's Lukoil want out of Iraq, why does China want to buy this interest in these Iraqi oil fields?
China looks at oil from a sort of mercantilist perspective, where they think that their energy security depends on having their companies physically at oil fields and securing the oil and being involved in those countries that are oil producers and oil exporters. So when China makes an investment decision in a place like Iraq, Chinese companies, which often function as an arm of the government, are much less concerned with profit and much more concerned with the strategic interests of the government. So they're generally willing to sacrifice profit margin in order to secure physical access to supply.
What does Iraq's oil ministry say about China potentially buying these stakes in Iraqi oil fields?
The oil ministry has been really wary of it. They were very welcoming of Chinese investment for a long time. And then there got to be this tipping point where all of a sudden, if ExxonMobil left the second or third largest field in the country, and if Lukoil left the second or third largest oil field in the country, and those interests were taken over by China, then all of a sudden you'd have China involved in oil fields representing, you know, roughly half of the country's production. And when you, as a country like Iraq, are so overweight in terms of investment from a single country, I think the worry is that that gives a single government like the Chinese government a little too much influence, too much sway.
So the West is vexed about reliance on Russian oil with the war in Ukraine. Is Washington looking at the situation in Iraq with ExxonMobil withdrawing and wondering, maybe worrying, if the U.S. might be making deals in the future with China?
I think the major question is not necessarily who has the oil contracts. The major question is, can Iraq do all of the things surrounding its oil sector to bring that supply online? And right now, the limiting factor isn't how much oil Iraq can get out of the ground. The limiting factor is the infrastructure that brings the oil from the oil wells to the ships in the Basra Gulf and in the Mediterranean. So really, from Washington's perspective, what they should be concerned about is all of the infrastructure surrounding the oil industry in Iraq.
And Ben, back to the constitutional kind of notion that it's the Iraqi citizens who own this oil. What do Iraqi people say about competing international interests in ownership of oil fields in their country?
In general, there's a lot of suspicion around what international oil companies are doing in Iraq. You know, I think there is this kind of mismatch between a sort of legacy of Iraq's socialist past and a lot of deserved pride in Iraq's ability to build an oil sector on its own and really bootstrap through an era of sanctions and war to keep an oil industry going, versus the reality as it looks to an international oil company, which is hey, you guys really need a whole lot of money in terms of upfront investment here. And if we're going to provide that, we need a reasonable rate of return.
Ben Van Heuvelin is editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report in New York, filling us in there on the growing influence of China in Iraq's oil industry. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you.
There is a small but growing group of extreme athletes in Sonora, Mexico, and they're pushing themselves to newer heights, surrounded by some stunning natural beauty. Better not be too distracting beauty, because the athletes are highliners. If you don't know, they're walking a tightrope strung between two high, steep cliffs. KJZZ reporter Murphy Woodhouse in Sonora brings us more about these daredevils.
It's mid-morning and warming up in a backyard citrus grove in remote Guasavas, Mexico. The town sits in a river valley flanked by soaring, dry sierras. Using the dirt as a whiteboard, a sizable, motley crew of adventurers, mostly Sonorans, a Belgian, even a ferret named Toto, puts the day's plan together. Their task deserves careful deliberation. It's about safely stringing tightropes across the chasms of Sonora's famed Cruz del Diablo, or Devil's Cross Canyon. These sheer stone walls rise hundreds of feet. To begin spanning one gap that day, they'll use a bow and arrow. Sitting in her tent, 22-year-old University of Sonora biology student Argelia Gil Samaniego is getting ready.
Le he estado dando al highline desde hace dos años.
She's been practicing highline for a few years. It's a discipline of the balancing sport called slacklining that features lines strung dozens or even hundreds of feet in the air. This will be Samaniego's most ambitious effort yet. She says she's fine with whatever she can achieve. What she knows for certain is that she's feeling strong and calm. Plan set, the group makes its way up the winding mountain road to the canyon. This will be the second and last full day of preparation for a long weekend of walking the lines. At a popular overlook some 2,000 feet above the valley floor, the group unloads harnesses, packs, food and water, and gears up for the hard work ahead. Abraham Puigfarat is the archer. He wraps a thin fishing line around a short length of pipe, like a fishing reel, so that the arrow draws the line cleanly as it flies through the air. Puigfarat is new to highline. Accompanying him to his perch is the much more experienced Osmar González, known as Pajarito, or Little Bird. Pajarito says he calls the Devil's Cross Sonora's Highline University. Breath-stilled and anchored to a tree, Puigfarat pulls the arrow back and raises the bow. Success. With the thin line across, a thicker one follows, and then, with three teams split up around the canyon, a slow, carefully choreographed effort to move their gear over the abyss.
¿Puedes recuperar?
A moment's carelessness could undo hours of tedious work. With shouts, whistles, and phone calls, they coordinate. Knots in the line and other complications frustrate, but the team works together to keep stress in check. Several hours after the arrow, they send the actual line they'll be walking across. It's flat webbing, an inch wide, with another dangling below in case the main line fails.
Una, dos, tres. Una, dos, tres.
They pull the line taut as the daylight starts to fade. In all, they set up three lines over the canyon.
A bower thing. Every little thing is gonna be all right.
With the Bob Marley anthem echoing between the walls and headlamps and a near full moon now the only light, Pajarito, the last of the north side team, pulls himself across the yawning blackness.
Creo que al ser tan grande nuestro estado y ser tan joven el deporte.
Back at camp the next morning, Pajarito says that the combination of vast, geographically diverse Sonora and such a young sport means that highlining has a lot of potential.
Te retan demasiado.
The Devil's Cross figures prominently in Sonora's highline world, he says. But its height and shifting winds are a serious challenge. It brings up questions, he says, like, is this really what I want to be doing? Luis Flores loses his balance and plummets before his safety rope catches him. Dangling hundreds of feet above the canyon floor, he gathers himself and climbs back up onto the line. To keep his focus, he sings to himself.
Paso,
and chance, and soon is back on firm ground. The shock is still with him after several minutes of cooling down, along with euphoria. Being close to death, Flores says, makes you feel alive. On a nearby line, Gil Samaniego, the biology student, is finding her balance.
Okay, Angelia.
Her friends help her back to the canyon's edge.
Del uno al diez, seis.
From 1 to 10, she put her fear at 6.
Ves las vistas, el equilibrio, la paz mental.
More powerful than the fear, though, were the views, the peace and equilibrium, she says.
Es tuyo el mundo ahí.
And the feeling that the whole world was hers. For The World, Murphy Woodhouse, in Sonora, Mexico.
Catch up with some of our latest stories and interviews you might have missed from Afghanistan and the Taliban's order for women to cover themselves head to toe while in public, to how the Comcac people of northern Mexico are protecting an underwater grass that can help fight climate change. Those and more stories are on our website, theworld.org. We close out today with music that's gone viral on social media, courtesy of a kid from Alberta, Canada. Noah Green is 12 years old. He's a singer from the Cree First Nation. Noah performs with his grandmother in a traditional hand drum group called Chubby Cree.
When we sing, we connect with the people that need the healing.
That's Noah's grandmother, Carol Powder, speaking to Al Jazeera in 2018.
Drumming is a form of healing because we connect with a person through their body, soul, spiritually.
Noah and his grandma have taken their songs of healing to rallies for missing and murdered Indigenous girls and women, and for the hundreds of children found in unmarked graves on former residential school grounds. This performance, posted on YouTube, was to, quote, honor the children who never made it home. The young singer, Noah Green, spoke to Global News Edmonton last year.
Sometimes, like, when we sing our songs, people cry. Every time we sing, it, like, I feel healing.
Something I hope we can all take solace from today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Stay strong. We'll be back with you tomorrow.